Chapter 7. Of neatness and simplicity, the work she admitted lay beside her. Her writing book was on the desk she leaned upon. From the mournful ruin of such bereavement, there had slowly risen up this gentle, tender, guileless, grateful-hearted being. Like other inmates of that house, she had a green ribbon bound round her eyelids. A doll she had dressed lay near upon the ground. I took it up, and saw that she had made a green fillet such as she wore herself, and fastened it about its mimic eyes. She was seated in a little enclosure, made by school desks and forms, writing her daily journal. But soon finishing this pursuit, she engaged in an animated conversation with a teacher who sat beside her. This was a favorite mistress with the poor pupil. If she could see the face of her fair instructress, she would not love her less, I am sure. I have extracted a few disjointed fragments of her history from an account written by that one man who has made her what she is. It is a very beautiful and touching narrative, and I wish I could present it entire. Her name is Laura Bridgman. She was born in Hanover, New Hampshire, on the 21st of December, 1829. She is described as having been a very sprightly and pretty infant, with bright blue eyes. She was, however, so puny and feeble until she was a year and a half old, that her parents hardly hoped to rear her. She was subject to severe fits, which seemed to rack her frame almost beyond her power of endurance. And life was held by the feeblest tenure. But when a year and a half old, she seemed to rally, the dangerous symptoms subsided. And at 20 months old, she was perfectly well. Then her mental powers, hitherto stinted in their growth, rapidly developed themselves, and during the 4 months of health which she enjoyed, she appears, making due allowance for a fond mother's account, to have displayed a considerable degree of intelligence. But suddenly she sickened again. Her disease raged with great violence during 5 weeks, when her eyes and ears were inflamed, suppurated, and their contents were discharged. But though sight and hearing were gone forever, the poor child's sufferings were not ended. The fever raged during 7 weeks. For 5 months she was kept in bed in a darkened room. It was a year before she could walk unsupported, and 2 years before she could sit up all day. It was now observed that her sense of smell was almost entirely destroyed, and, consequently, that her taste was much blunted. It was not until 4 years of age that the poor child's bodily health seemed restored, and she was able to enter upon her apprenticeship of life and the world. But what a situation was hers! The darkness and the silence of the tomb were around her. No mother's smile called forth her answering smile, no father's voice taught her to imitate his sounds. They, brothers and sisters, were but forms of matter which resisted her touch, but which differed not from the furniture of the house, save in warmth, and in the power of locomotion, and not even in these respects from the dog and the cat. But the immortal spirit which had been implanted within her could not die, nor be maimed nor mutilated. And though most of its avenues of communication with the world were cut off, it began to manifest itself through the others. As soon as she could walk, she began to explore the room, and then the house. She became familiar with the form, density, weight, and heat of every article she could lay her hands upon. She followed her mother, and felt her hands and arms, as she was occupied about the house, and her disposition to imitate led her to repeat everything herself. She even learned to sew a little, and to knit. Apostrophe, the reader will scarcely need to be told, however, that the opportunities of communicating with her were very, very limited, and that the moral effects of her wretched state soon began to appear. Those who cannot be enlightened by reason can only be controlled by force, and this, coupled with her great privations, must soon have reduced her to a worse condition than that of the beasts that perish, but for timely and unhoped for aid. At this time, I was so fortunate as to hear of the child, and immediately hastened to Hanover to see her. I found her with a well-formed figure, a strongly marked, nervous, sanguine temperament, a large and beautifully shaped head, and the whole system in healthy action. The parents were easily induced to consent to her coming to Boston, and on the 4th of October, 1837, they brought her to the institution. For a while, she was much bewildered, and after waiting about 2 weeks, until she became acquainted with her new locality, and somewhat familiar with the inmates, the attempt was made to give her knowledge of arbitrary signs, by which she could interchange thoughts with others. There was one of two ways to be adopted. Either to go on to build up a language of signs on the basis of the natural language which she had already commenced herself, or to teach her the purely arbitrary language in common use. That is, to give her a sign for every individual thing, or to give her a knowledge of letters by combination, of which she might express her idea of the existence, and the mode and condition of existence, of anything. The former would have been easy, but very ineffectual. The latter seemed very difficult, but, if accomplished, very effectual. I determined therefore to try the latter. The first experiments were made, by taking articles in common use, such as knives, forks, spoons, keys, etc., and pasting upon them labels with their names printed in raised letters. These she felt very carefully, and soon, of course, distinguished that the crooked line spoon differed as much from the crooked line's key as the spoon differed from the key in form. Then small detached labels, with the same words printed upon them, were put into her hands, and she soon observed that they were similar to the ones pasted on the articles. Apostrophe she showed her perception of the similarity by laying the label key upon the key and the label spoon upon the spoon. She was encouraged here by the natural sign of approbation, patting on the head. The same process was then repeated with all the articles which she could handle, and she very easily learned to place the proper labels upon them. It was evident, however, that the only intellectual exercise was that of imitation and memory. She recollected that the label book was placed upon a book, and she repeated the process first from imitation, next from memory, with only the motive of love of approbation, but apparently without the intellectual perception of any relation between the things. After a while, instead of labels, the individual letters were given to her on detached bits of paper. They were arranged side by side so as to spell book, key, and C semicolon. Then they were mixed up in a heap, and a sign was made for her to arrange them herself so as to express the words book, key, and C semicolon, and she did so. Hitherto, the process had been mechanical, and the success about as great as teaching a very knowing dog a variety of tricks. The poor child had sat in mute amazement, and patiently imitated everything her teacher did. But now the truth began to flash upon her. Her intellect began to work. She perceived that here was a way by which she could herself make up a sign of anything that was in her own mind, and show it to another mind, and at once her countenance lighted up with a human expression. It was no longer a dog, or parrot. It was an immortal spirit, eagerly seizing upon a new link of union with other spirits. I could almost fix upon the moment when this truth dawned upon her mind, and spread its light to her countenance. I saw that the great obstacle was overcome, and that henceforward nothing but patient and persevering, but plain and straightforward, efforts were to be used. The result thus far is quickly related, and easily conceived. But not so was the process. For many weeks of apparently unprofitable labor were passed before it was effected. When it was said above that a sign was made, it was intended to say that the action was performed by her teacher, she feeling his hands, and then imitating the motion. The next step was to procure a set of metal types, with the different letters of the alphabet cast upon their ends. Also a board, in which were square holes, into which holes she could set the types, so that the letters on their ends could alone be felt above the surface. Then, on any article being handed to her, for instance, a pencil or a watch, she would select the component letters and arrange them on her board and read them with apparent pleasure. She was exercised for several weeks in this way, until her vocabulary became extensive. And then the important step was taken of teaching her how to represent the different letters by the position of her fingers, instead of the cumbrous apparatus of the board and types. She accomplished this speedily and easily, for her intellect had begun to work in aid of her teacher, and her progress was rapid. This was the period, about 3 months, after she had commenced, that the first report of her case was made, in which it was stated that she has just learned the manual alphabet, as used by the deaf-mutes, and it is a subject of delight and wonder to see how rapidly, correctly, and eagerly she goes on with her labors. Her teacher gives her a new object, for instance, a pencil, first lets her examine it and get an idea of its use, then teaches her how to spell it by making the signs for the letters with her own fingers. The child grasps her hand and feels her fingers as the different letters are formed. She turns her head a little on one side like a person listening closely. Her lips are apart. She seems scarcely to breathe. And her countenance, at first anxious, gradually changes to a smile as she comprehends the lesson. She then holds up her tiny fingers and spells the word in the manual alphabet. Next, she takes her types and arranges her letters. And last, to make sure that she is right, she takes the whole of the types composing the word and places them upon her in contact with the pencil or whatever the object may be. The whole of the succeeding year was passed in gratifying her eager inquiries for the names of every object which she could possibly handle, in exercising her in the use of the manual alphabet, in extending in every possible way her knowledge of the physical relations of things, and in proper care of her health. At the end of the year, a report of her case was made, from which the following is an extract. It has been ascertained beyond the possibility of doubt that she cannot see a ray of light, cannot hear the least sound, and never exercises her sense of smell, if she have any. Thus her mind dwells in darkness and stillness, as profound as that of a closed tomb at midnight. Of beautiful sights, and sweet sounds, and pleasant odors, she has no conception. Nevertheless, she seems as happy and playful as a bird or a lamb, and the employment of her intellectual faculties, or the acquirement of a new idea, gives her a vivid pleasure, which is plainly marked in her expressive features. She never seems to repine, but has all the buoyancy and gaiety of childhood. She is fond of fun and frolic, and when playing with the rest of the children, her shrill laugh sounds loudest of the group. When left alone, she seems very happy, if she have her knitting or sewing, and will busy herself for hours. If she have no occupation, she evidently amuses herself by imaginary dialogues, or by recalling past impressions. She counts with her fingers, or spells out names of things which she has recently learned, in the manual alphabet of the deaf-mutes. In this lonely self-communion she seems to reason, reflect, and argue. If she spell a word wrong with the fingers of her right hand, she instantly strikes it with her left, as her teacher does, in sign of disapprobation. If right, then she pats herself upon the head, and looks pleased. She sometimes purposely spells a word wrong with the left hand, looks roguish for a moment and laughs, and then with the right hand strikes the left, as if to correct it. During the year she has attained great dexterity in the use of the manual alphabet of the deaf-mutes, and she spells out the words and sentences which she knows, so fast and so deftly, that only those accustomed to this language can follow with the eye the rapid motions of her fingers. But wonderful as is the rapidity with which she writes her thoughts upon the air, still more so is the ease and accuracy with which she reads the words thus written by another, grasping their hands in hers, and following every movement of their fingers, as letter after letter conveys their meaning to her mind. It is in this way that she converses with her blind playmates, and nothing can more forcibly show the power of mind in forcing matter to its purpose than a meeting between them. For if great talent and skill are necessary for two pantomimes, to paint their thoughts and feelings by the movements of the body and the expression of the countenance. How much greater the difficulty when darkness shrouds them both, and the one can hear no sound. When Laura is walking through a passageway, with her hands spread before her, she knows instantly everyone she meets, and passes them with a sign of recognition. But if it be a girl of her own age, and especially if it be one of her favorites, there is instantly a bright smile of recognition, a twining of arms, a grasping of hands, and a swift telegraphing upon the tiny fingers, whose rapid evolutions convey the thoughts and feelings from the outposts of one mind to those of the other. There are questions and answers, exchanges of joy or sorrow, there are kissings and partings, just as between little children with all their senses. During this year and 6 months after she had left home, her mother came to visit her, and the scene of their meeting was an interesting one. The mother stood some time, gazing with overflowing eyes upon her unfortunate child, who, all unconscious of her presence, was playing about the room. Presently Laura ran against her, and at once began feeling her hands, examining her dress, and trying to find out if she knew her. But not succeeding in this, she turned away, as from a stranger, and the poor woman could not conceal the pang she felt at finding that her beloved child did not know her. She then gave Laura a string of beads which she used to wear at home, which were recognized by the child at once, who, with much joy, put them around her neck, and sought me eagerly to say she understood the string was from her home. The mother now sought to caress her, but poor Laura repelled her, preferring to be with her acquaintances. Another article from home was now given her, and she began to look much interested. She examined the stranger much closer, and gave me to understand that she knew she came from Hanover. She even endured her caresses, but would leave her with indifference at the slightest signal. The distress of the mother was now painful to behold. For, although she had feared that she should not be recognized, the painful reality of being treated with cold indifference by a darling child was too much for woman's nature to bear. After a while, on the mother taking hold of her again, a vague idea seemed to flit across Laura's mind that this could not be a stranger. She therefore felt her hands very eagerly, while her countenance assumed an expression of intense interest. She became very pale, and then suddenly red. Hope seemed struggling with doubt and anxiety, and never were contending emotions more strongly painted upon the human face. At this moment of painful uncertainty, the mother drew her close to her side, and kissed her fondly, when at once the truth flashed upon the child, and all mistrust and anxiety disappeared from her face, as with an expression of exceeding joy she eagerly nestled to the bosom of her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.